Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening around the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and it's good to be back for another week with my co-hosts, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune. Gents, wonderful to see you both.
Good to be with you, mate.
Yeah.
Well, a theme of these podcasts lately has sort of been a little bit reflective of what's been happening in the world, and you will certainly hope so given the name of this podcast, but the tensions that's been boiling up in the Middle East and then, of course, in Asia and the internal tensions in the US. But two countries that, to be honest with you, I never thought would be fighting have started to do exactly that. And this is India and Canada this week. They've just expelled their top envoys along with other diplomats as a row intensifies over it. An assassination of a Sikh separatist on Canadian soil, which happened last year. Ozan, talk us through what on earth is going on.
Well, yeah, so this has been something that's been simmering, I suppose, as a dispute, a diplomatic dispute between the two countries for about 18 months. It was ignited by the assassination of what the Indians referred to as a Sikh separatist. Obviously, there's a massive Sikh population in Canada, the Canadians are saying that there is firm evidence, and I think they've made some of that evidence available to suggest that Indian diplomats are actually actively plotting, gaining or gathering intelligence and making quite a bit of trouble for some of the local Sikh community. And of course, the Indian government has accused Canada of playing politics with this, and has branded it a politically motivated act. So yes, it's been a bit of a tit for tat. I think the Canadians have expelled the Indian diplomats. India responded pretty swiftly with doing the same for the Canadian diplomats. And look, I think this is something that you wouldn't expect, but it's very interesting. And considering that the Canadian, the Sikh community, of course, does have quite a bit of political importance for Prime Minister Trudeau's coalition. There's, as I mentioned, significant community. There's probably every reason to assume that this is something that might be of political interest for the Canadians. But at the end of the day, they seem to have pretty compelling evidence. So it's one to watch.
How are you reading what's happening, Rodney, politically? I mean, the expelling of diplomats and whatnot, that's kind of that's a bit of a nothing move, isn't it? Don't countries do this stuff all the time?
Yes, but, you know, first of all, you're talking about two Commonwealth member states, the High Commissioner themselves, Indian High Commissioner in Canada was one of those expelled. So it's at a senior level. And I guess what we're seeing potentially is the first evidence of what happens when you have a more authoritarian government at home, and how that translates into foreign policy as well. So it may be that this is the first of a number of these types of episodes that India find themselves involved in, or potentially the last, depending on how much adverse publicity it attracts. But it's certainly the outworkings or visual or more transparent manifestation of what's going on behind the scenes. Canada is absolutely bang on confident that they have very clear evidence that government agents or officialdom was involved in this particular plot. And of course, the latest cycle of expulsions comes because the Canadian government, they made a number of arrests. Those arrests were of Indian nationals, and they then said that they would be going on to investigate further not just the people who carried out the act, but those who sanctioned, ordered, or directed it in the first place. And they've returned to the door of the Indian High Commission in Canada to ask further questions. Or at least hand over the evidence. So it's pretty bad for India. It's pretty bad for India-Canada relations. It will hit on trade and other things. But the Canadian government seems to be pretty resolute in its position in relation to this.
And it's clearly not something that Canada would take lightly, right? I mean, you know, all around the world, you're seeing countries and institutions like the EU trying to sort of develop their relations with India, which is obviously, you know, an incredibly growing population, a strategic one. Economically, it's growing, etc., and will likely be or continue to be a big player on the global stage in the future, if not, you know, if not now. What sort of foreign political implications, Ozan, do you think this then has on, you know, the India-Canada relations, but also potentially other Commonwealth and other, you know, sort of Western English-speaking countries, do you think?
No, I think it's a very good point. It feeds directly to the narrative that has been pushed for some time around where India is from its domestic politics point of view. Certainly that narrative was very prominent around Modi's absolute grip on power, the relationship between the minorities, so the non-Hindu, I suppose, minorities, and it I think is of great concern to many around the world who look at India as a trading partner, but also India's quite important role that it plays geopolitically. I think Trudeau famously commented that he had four cabinet members, and that was more than what Modi had at the time in India, in his cabinet in Canada. So, you know, I think this narrative and this underlying thinking around the relationship between the majority and the minority in India is playing on a lot of people's minds. We saw that during the election. Some could argue, I certainly won't. I'm not an expert on Indian politics, but some may argue that the recent election that we had was a little bit of a backlash, particularly in some of those local areas, a backlash against Modi's grip on power, but also the, I suppose, way in which Modi and the ruling BJP are looking at the relationships between some of those regions, some of the non-Hindu minorities, the Muslims, of course, in this case, the Sikhs as well. This is a real concern, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, you say about not an expert in domestic politics, the people who will be forming an opinion about India as a result of this, whether it be in the West or elsewhere in English-speaking countries or in the Commonwealth, it's the one that we touched on, Erdem. They're also not going to be experts in Indian domestic policy, but they'll have a view of India as a result of this. It's sort of in a sense, you know, countries didn't want to have bad relations with Saudi Arabia, but what happened in terms of the allegation and then investigation and so on in relation to Khashoggi, and obviously it was a different, a more chilling news reporting of the how, you know, he met his end and so on. It forced people's hand in a way that, you know, many Western countries didn't want to have to visibly chill relations in order to satisfy a domestic constituency or audience. And this type of thing for India may force the hands of countries that they want to maintain good relations with, because it, you know, whatever people may think of the good people of Canada or Trudeau or his government, there's no one really alleging that they've in some way fabricated evidence or that they're so clueless that they would get something like this wrong before acting on it. So it's really unhelpful for India, possibly saved by the fact that with Russia, Ukraine and other theatres where there is huge global instability, that the last thing that many countries will want is friction with India. So I think this is unhelpful all round, but it may prove to be something that India has to navigate around, and certainly in terms of how they conduct themselves abroad and what you might describe as willingly friendly countries in the future, they're going to have to really be super careful.
It'll be interesting to see whether the narrative that the Indian government's trying to put out there gets any traction in Canada. I mean, we see, of course, I wouldn't ever suggest that Canada and the US is the same, but, you know, only a few hundred miles down south, you see a narrative that Russia has pushed out over many years, really getting traction and picking up. And you know, one could argue that Trump's successes have been heavily influenced by Russian misinformation and Russian information out there. So it will be interesting to see what type of domestic influence that this has. And I can see perhaps some of the conservative parties in Canada perhaps looking at it and saying, well, this is very politically motivated, particularly a bit more of the populist ones. You know, we would never be having a conversation like this 10, 15 years ago, because obviously national security would have trumped everything. But I mean, I think we live in a world where particularly certain populist parties will, you know, will basically go anywhere with these sorts of things, and they will not stop at anything to try and score political points, even if it means that they're taking the side of a narrative that a foreign government has put forward into the domestic political realm over what the government has put forward, which would be national security interests, etc. So it will be interesting. I think another point here is that you know, India's economy is at a time when, I don't know the exact details, but exact statistics, but I think, you know, in the last 12 months, Indian IPOs have been some of the most successful in the world. The foreign direct investment into India is almost at record high, etc. This has the potential to really dampen the foreign investment element of it as well for India if it starts to become a bigger piece of news. That's a big if. There's a lot going on in the world, as you mentioned, Adam, with the Middle East and what's happening in Taiwan. But of course, U.S. elections are taking up everyone's bandwidth as well. So let's see how long and how far this story goes beyond those two countries.
Indeed, and let's see what side, if any, other countries do take. Obviously, Canada is a member of NATO, of the G7, of the G20. And it's obviously part of the Five Eyes group of Western countries. Yeah. And then you've got India, which is a, you know, an ally of so many others, such as, you know, the US and the EU, particularly from a trading partner perspective. And so all this dynamic will naturally play out against the backdrop, of course, of some other key things that you just mentioned there, Ozan, one of them being the election in the US. Exactly 3 weeks to go now. And Rodney, it is as close as it possibly could be. How have you seen what's been happening in the US over the last week since we last spoke?
Well, it's been fascinating, as always, to follow Trump and what he's talking about. I mean, he's gone from Haitians in Springfield to Venezuelans in Aurora when he went to speak there. Street gangs that were, I don't know what they were doing, but they were doing a lot of crime. Were they bringing disease as well, possibly? And some of the most violent people on earth and so on. So he was... He was doubling down on this sort of Labour, and of course Harris had been the person who had brought them. So it's not even about immigration policy anymore, that she had invited these people here deliberately to bring disease and spread violence and so on. And this was contradicted by the Republican mayor of said Aurora, who said it was grossly exaggerated. So not that that'll make any difference to Trump. So he's still on this sort of rhetoric and so on. However, he's also declared his absolutely amazing and never-ending affection for black male voters, which he's done now at a number of rallies, and that is the area we talked about, the Latino vote, last week. But Harris is unveiling a list of policies to appeal to black male voters because she's simply not doing as well with that constituency as Biden or Hillary Clinton did in important states such as Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. 3 weeks ago, she had a 2-point lead in each of those states. That's now down to 1 point. And that sort of contrasts with Clinton and Biden, who both were 8 points up in those states, although they didn't obviously win by 8 points. So as well as this series of policies and so on, they appeal to black male voters. She's going to be touring Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Atlanta this week. Trump's also in Atlanta. And I expect that we're going, and she's doing more media, I think we've seen. So that level of media confidence has got there, or within her team to say we need to do more media. But as is Trump, and the target in the next week is on the economy, but it's also focused on black male voters.
So many media outlets in the US are really criticizing the Harris campaign, as, you know, CNN said that it's struggling to restore momentum. MSNBC has said that, you know, many Democrats are saying that the message just isn't breaking through to key voters. Politico saying that there's anxiousness amongst the Dems in what is the coin toss election, of course. The New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd said, "Where is the fierce urgency of beating Trump?" It feels like, I mean, let's call a spade, the polls are way too close to make an assumption at all. But all this media narrative, Ozan, is that a view you subscribe to, that by now, if we rewind to July, by now many would have assumed, not only commentators, but obviously the Democrat camp as well, that Harris would have had enough of a lead to almost have a decisive victory over Trump. Would you agree that that's sort of where we would have assumed where we are today?
Yeah, certainly. I think we would have all assumed that. However, what's become very clear is that this race is extremely tight, and it's going to remain that way until November 5th. There is no doubt about it. I heard an interview with David Plouffe, one of the senior advisors to Kamala Harris, and he is of the view that this will continue to be a very, very tight race. And it will continue to be the polls will continue to show a difference between the two candidates that's well within the margin of error. So 1-3%, depending obviously on the poll. And his view was that it would really come down to turnout. And, you know, you can model a lot of different scenarios around who's actually going to vote. The polls say something, but at the end of the day, the only poll that matters is the one on polling day. So yes, she should be leading in a normal world. If we were living in one, she should be leading by 7, 8, 10. She should win by 7, 8, 10 percentage points, but we're not living in that world. It's very clear that Trump will end up getting, I think, 47-48% in most states. It's just whether Kamala Harris can sway those undecided voters on election day, if she can ensure that some of those people perhaps that may have not wanted to vote or had indicated 3-4 months ago that they weren't going to vote for either candidate, she can convince them to vote for her. I think we could have a very different result, but I don't expect the result to be very dissimilar to what we are seeing in the polls. Now, there's a big question, and you know, amongst all the polling nerds, around whether the polls have kind of swung, or the pendulum swung in terms of the polls, and you know, instead of underestimating the Trump vote, they're now overestimating it. But I think that all of those things are just speculation, and I don't think it's helpful to have a conversation around any of those things, because it's very clear. I think both public polls and the campaign internal polls, from what I understand, are both showing that this is as tight as it can get, and it's going to be continue being that until the votes are tallied up and all the votes are counted. That was supposed to be the case last time around as well, but as we know, the former president wanted some votes to be counted in some states, and you know, the vote counted to stop in others. So let's see. I'm expecting a lot of shenanigans on the night, and it's going to be a fascinating thing to watch. What I do though find interesting, and I think I mentioned to you both last week that I was extremely confused about what the strategy was. I remain confused still with Trump's strategy. I mean, he's still on, as Rodney very well put, on a whole bunch of issues that, in my opinion, aren't going to change the outcome for him or really increase his support. He tried very hard, as did the Republicans generally, to criticize the government's President Biden and by definition, Vice President Kamala Harris's response to Hurricane Milton. I'm not sure that resonated. Obviously, there's been not enough polls to see whether that's had an influence. But yeah. Again, it doesn't seem to be that there's a coherent strategy there. I'm less surprised, though, that Kamala Harris's campaign has become, you know, as we were discussing last week, a lot more aggressive on Trump and really kind of shining a light on that contrast between the two candidates. And, you know, she's, I think, referred to him at a rally in Pennsylvania yesterday or the day before as growing more and more unhinged. And these are the sorts of things I suspect we're going to see more of, because I think, yes, 10-point plans on the economy and, you know, immigration policy, et cetera, these are all things that she needs to do. But her biggest weapon, or the campaign's biggest weapon, is to clearly show that contrast. And, you know, Trump's unpopular enough and his favorability is low enough that some of that might actually work to get people to get off the couch and go to the polls on November 5th.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the frustration and criticism of the campaign that was flagged at the outset is more a reflection on a frustration that she's not further ahead by now. And it is still neck and neck from some of those mainstream media outlets, because she is unveiling targeted economic policies tied to clear voter groups. She's taking on media opportunities to connect with that audience. But Trump just sucks oxygen. Whether he's talking about the enemy from within and other things, which aren't going to win him any votes anywhere, and certainly not undecideds who might be nervous about voting for him anyway. But he just dominates the media and the news cycle as a result of some of this craziness. And it just doesn't seem to damage his base or core vote in any way whatsoever. The crazier he is, the more media time it takes up, the less coverage there is of what she's trying to achieve. And we go round again, and it's still neck and neck.
I think what's really interesting is if the election is close, which I think, you know, everyone would agree it's going to be, and the polls suggest it will be, we might not know the outcome for days even after the poll. But, you know, Trump, I think, is really laying the groundwork for continued chaos, even if he loses on the night or, you know, a few days after, right? I mean, he did this, or he tried to do this in 2020. But all these outrageous things that he is saying, and I don't say outrageous because I'm taking a political stance on this. I say outrageous because of the way he says it and the impact that it sort of has. That, you know, things like that Harris will only win if she cheats. That, you know, nominating Harris instead of Joe Biden was unconstitutional by the Democrats. That the electoral system is plagued by voter fraud, et cetera, et cetera. All these claims that he makes, to me, is just he's laying the framework to dispute once again the results. And this time it's going to be trickier, I think, because of how tight the race is and, you know, what could ensue as a result of what is happening. And we're seeing something similar on the other side, where the Democrats are, you know, threatening to sue, and in some cases have started the processes around sort of some of those really tight seats and some of the counties where it will come down to a handful of votes. To me, it's, you know, he sucks the oxygen, to your point, Rodney, because of these claims that he continuously makes. You know, media and society is grappling with extreme voices on both sides of the debate. The problem is Kamala Harris is not on the extreme voice of the other side in order to be able to have a bit of that oxygen and to sway that her media a little bit. You know, she's playing on the card of, you know, the cool, calm, collected auntie who, you know, makes pancakes with her nieces, or I think stepchildren on weekends. You know, she's told that story a few times now when she received the call with Joe Biden. Then you get someone like Obama come out this week to that rally that they held in Pennsylvania, and he goes all out and he talks about, you know, Trump being a billionaire who complains about his problems, and he has, you know, what he said a few times now, he has a weird obsession with crowd sizes and what's his obsession with size. And I mean, you almost, that's the sort of stuff that the media is looking for to be able to suck the oxygen out. It just doesn't feel like the Harris camp has that.
No, but even on the billionaire stuff, they're running conflicting narratives themselves around that. On the one sense, he's a billionaire, he's had privilege, he's detached and all this other stuff. And then on the other side, they want to say he's a failed businessman. He ruined a fortune and he only maintains any standing or wealth or privilege through constant litigation and covering up of his different business ventures and so on. So I still think even on that point, they need to either say he's not very good at business, or he's a successful businessman who is absolutely detached from you, the average American or something, and he doesn't care because he's motivated by making money, and that whole thing's fine. But I think they're too often trying to ride two horses in some of the stuff that they say about him, and it doesn't work for them. In contrast to Trump, who can say two things in a sentence, and of course he doesn't get criticized for it in any way. It doesn't matter with his voter base, and he doesn't lose any currency as a result of it.
Look, I think at this late stage, calling him a billionaire, okay, fine. But you know, he's been on the stage for the last 9 years. He has 100% name recognition. I don't think there's anybody in the world that doesn't know who Trump is and what type of character he has and his failings and his successes, etc. You know, trying to paint a picture of him at this late stage is, I think, fruitless. And if you ask me, a waste of time. It's, again, they've got to go back to what is on the record as what he has done, what he did. And they have a lot of ammunition there. I mean, the abortion stuff is playing, continues, I believe, to play very nicely. A lot of the undecided voters, I believe, and the independents, if you can call them that, are all people who are quite concerned about the limitless power and the unchecked power that Trump is trying to obtain for himself through this whole election process. These are things that I think they've just got to now down and continue to kind of focus on. I think Obama is obviously a rock star for the Democrats. But again, I don't think having Obama do a few rallies is going to do the trick. I think they need to really, particularly for, you know, many of the voters, of the young voters, none of them ever got to vote for Obama. I mean, you know, all they've known is Trump. And, you know, trying to reach out to these people through social media and through various means and try and highlight to them that actually, you know what, these are the issues that you need to be concerned about. This is, you know, at the end of the day, you can't change the perception that somebody has of Trump. You either hate him or you love him. But what you can do is you can point to things that he's tried to do. He has done, and you know, reach out to those people who may not have decided whether they're going to vote or not. Really, at the end of the day, I think what's going to make the difference between whether Trump wins or Kamala Harris wins is how many of those people who, in the next 3 weeks, change their mind and decide to vote and vote for either of those parties.
Just on that one final point, I saw some polling in the weekend. And favorability towards his time, might have been Friday, I had a look at this, to his time as president was higher than the Biden-Harris administration. And that's not going to change over the next. There's not going to be an effort to reanalyze his time in office. It's a nostalgia point. It's a passage of time point. It's the Harrison-Biden are in recent memory. It's about how people feel about their disposable income or current wealth,
exactly.
And so on. So what I think we'll see over the next 2 weeks is, yes, there's a focus on the economy, but it's going to circle back on two issues, and it's going to be Trump is a danger to democracy. He is authoritarian by nature. This is a risk to America. And then the other thing's going to be, even if you liked him before, his mental competence now is at a level where he is too old. And we're going to go back around on those two things, and they'll circle back again and again. And that seems to be part of the more aggressive content that's starting to come into Harris's campaign engagements as well.
I mean, Trump will steal away your private health cover that you got through the, you know, Affordable Care Act. Trump's tariff policies will mean an extra $4,000 or $5,000. I heard a couple of economists talk about it will increase cost of living inflation. At record highs, etc. These are the things, Rodney, that flowing on from what you're saying, these are the things that I think they will be pushing, and they need to be pushing, because this is what's going to get people to go, okay, this is too risky. I mean, they really need to start getting much more aggressive and negative. And I mean, look, we've spent a lot of time in the last 15 minutes talking about what the Harris campaign would do. you know, when you look at the Trump campaign, I mean, the only advice I can give is, you know, just don't get Trump out of there and just rely on paid media. And, you know, the less people see of Trump in the next 21 days is better for their campaign, in my humble opinion.
The economy stuff, there's Brexit all over again, right? You need the emotional argument as well. And if American voters have got to the point where they think it will be crap no matter who wins, and yep, they're still not going to be any better off, there's a temptation to throw the hand grenade and just say, well, let's just bring chaos. I'm not going to be any worse off. And I do feel that must be some of the sentiment that sits behind some Trump voters, not just the evangelical thing, not just the conservative thing, not just the misogynistic thing, which does appeal to some people, that there is a chaos element to what some people think. It's not going to, it can't get any worse for me. I might as well do it anyway.
Well, I mean, they're all locked in, as are most of the Harris voters. The next 21 days is all about that 2 or 3% of the population who is going to end up voting. And, you know, they're motivated by very, very different things. So the less they see of Trump, the better, I think, for the Trump campaign.
But if they see less of Trump on this one point, Ozan, are they not going to see more of Harris? Is that not the risk for the Trump campaign? Part of the sending them out to be crazy is it just drowns her out.
True. That is also a risk for the Trump campaign too, because, I mean, you don't want to give Harris some free air there. So it's true.
Well, you mentioned hand grenades, Rodney, and the possibility of people throwing that. One was thrown on the other side of the world in another continent by the deputy mayor of Prague this week when he announced that nighttime pub crawls were being banned in the city to attract more cultured and wealthier tourists. Basically, apparently, only people go to Prague who go there for a short time to get drunk, and in a city where beer is often cheaper than water in most restaurants. Ozan, is this going to work?
Look, I've never been to Prague, but I've certainly heard lots of stories of friends who've been there. So I suspect, I'm not sure whether it's going to work or not. I think you've got to stick to your strengths when it comes to, I think, the tourist kind of model that you've developed and the tourism service that you're providing as a government. I think it's personally quite offensive to many of the people who might come there to enjoy many of the wonderful beers that I'm sure Prague has to offer. It's quite offensive to those people to somehow label them as not all that cultured. But look, I think it goes to the broader question of what is the strategy, and to, you know, I think tourism, particularly in the wake of or post the pandemic, I think you see many, many countries positioning themselves and really rebranding and recreating their tourism offer. And I'm a bit surprised that they wouldn't be playing on their heritage as a place of you know, iconic beer and the history of that. You know, as a very strong supporter of beer in many forms, I honestly think that you can make beer more cultured, and I think they should focus on that rather than other things that they might have in mind.
I think from my perspective, it's fine to set an objective as a tourism ministry or as a government that you want to attract a certain demographic of tourists that will spend more per head per day or whatever, and actually most countries work this out pretty clearly, or most countries that perform well in this space do that, and then they target tourists from that particular high spending demographic through supporting their airlines to ensure that there's connections, to ensure that it's aligned to whatever investment attraction they want to run, and even to attract the attraction of foreign students. So everything is all pointing in exactly the same direction. I fear that Prague hasn't necessarily done this. They've decided who the low-spending tourists are, who they don't want, but probably don't have a plan in place to replace them, because, you know, even with high-spending tourists who may be seasonal, you need to find out what you're going to run the rest of the year to sustain the connectivity, to continue to attract people to occupy the hotels and spend X number of dollars per day per trip and so on to support the type of restaurants and other businesses that you want to spin out from your tourism. How many times do we see a location advertised in another country where there's no real direct flights or support for people speaking that language as their first language in the country that they're trying to attract people to and so on? And there's just simply not the infrastructure or support to deliver the outcomes you want. So yeah, it's fine to say we don't want drunken yobs and stag doos, but until you've got a clear plan of how to replace them and phase them out, you've got to be very careful going down that line. Unless this is the first step of attracting those people and they're saying these are the undesirables now, will you consider coming? But they need all the other pieces of the jigsaw in place to make it work economically, and they'll cause some disruption domestically, certainly within the city, to the service industries who supply those types of customers that they have relied on for their tourism over the past number of years.
But I mean, you've really got to look at it from the point of view. And look, what's the most high value tourist in terms of dollars spent per head, et cetera? It's that segment of tourism is the meetings, incentives, conferences and exhibitions segment, commonly known as MICE. But you don't go, as you said, Roddy, this might be the first step in a number of steps, but you don't go there overnight. I mean, first and foremost, Prague is not a commercial center. It's not a regional hub. It needs to often people feel that, okay, tourism is a standalone sector or industry on its own. No, it's not. It tourism is something that follows on from, other industries that you've invested into. And some countries have done this amazingly well. I mean, you have a look at, Singapore, for example, is becoming a meetings center, and various other places. But that hasn't happened overnight. That's happened because they've also been able to attract many different investors into the country, many different industries into the country. And I've got to say, if you're looking for the most high value tourists, they're going to really want to enjoy a beer in between meetings. So they've got to keep beer in that as an ingredient in that formula, I've got to say.
Yeah, I think we can all agree they shouldn't turn off the taps. I think that's fair enough.
I knew there was a pun. I knew there was a pun coming here from Rodney. There just had to be the right.
You need to moderate this before it goes any further.
Mate, I'm the most worrying thing in this Prague story and the discussion that we've just had is that Ozan, you have not been to Prague, given your incredible love for the alcoholic beverage that they're banning. I cannot believe that you've never been to that city, my friend.
Well, I've got to add it to the list. Trust me, I've drunk beer in many cities around the world, but never made it to Prague. I should go there before, as Rodney said, they turn off the tap.
Well, speaking of around the world, one topic has made some headlines and some controversy around the world. I have a question before I get to Ozan, because I know you have views around this. But Rodney, where is Christopher Columbus from?
Do you want to, the honest answer is I don't really care. And that's part of my less interest in this story. And as much as I enjoy history, and I enjoy some notable history podcasts that I would listen to regularly, I just don't find this story particularly exciting or interesting. I know that it's, his Christopher Columbus, whatever theme from last week, and we hear all these different pronouncements from South American governments and so on. But yeah, I mean, he did say something once about the fresh air of Seville, so maybe that was a clue that he was somewhere else in that region in the first place. I don't know. Who
Yeah,
knows?
you're pretty close. So I ask the source of truth, ChatGPT, and ChatGPT tells me that Christopher Columbus was from Genoa, a city-state in what is now Italy, born in or around the 15th century, the middle of the 15th century, and that he was a Catholic Christian. Now, Ozan, Spanish scientists tell us otherwise.
Well, the Spanish scientists have spent, I believe, the better half of a year trying to figure this out through some very complex and high-tech DNA testing. I believe they tested his son, or the obviously the what's left of his son, I think bones and his brother, and they've come up with the theory that he was actually born somewhere in Western or Valencia, they say, so Spain. That's what they believe. And also that he was actually of Jewish descent. And they have another theory running, and that is that he converted to avoid persecution, and became obviously a very successful ambassador to the Catholic Spanish monarch at the time, and went and discovered everything that he discovered. Now, I think, I mean, I have a couple of very strong views on this one. It's first and foremost, like, why does it take a year to figure out where your DNA is from? I mean, my parents did it in you know, 3 weeks through Ancestry.com. So I really want to know what went into this process and why it took a year, and haven't these people got anything better to do? And the second point is that that apparently there's about 20 countries who until now had falsely claimed that Christopher Columbus was one of theirs, or had been born in their country. And amongst them was a number of Scandinavian countries, Portugal, but also Greece. And as you know, as someone who is of Turkish heritage, having grown up in Melbourne, you know, this is just so typical that all my Greek friends stole tzatziki from the Turks, and they stole all of our kebabs, and here they are trying to claim Christopher Columbus, and they've been proven wrong. The DNA never lies, and I think that's a very important takeaway from this topic, and this is something that I'm going to enjoy discussing and raising with my my beloved Greek friends.
I take it all back, Ozan. Now you've made that case for why this is an interesting story. I'm 100% on your side.
Well, you know, we cover all the important topics here on Put Simply, Rodney.
We might need just a Christopher Columbus podcast next week, gents.
Yeah, I think it should all be about Columbus from now on.
I don't know how much simply we can put it than Spanish scientists, but a good place to leave it. Gents, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you this week. See you next.
Thank you.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.